When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on Cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
In a post-apocalyptic ice age that forces survivors aboard a super train, one man will risk everything for control of the engine and the future of the world. Starring Chris Evans and Tilda Swinton, Snowpiercer is available on demand now while it's in theaters. Starting August 1st, watch The One I Love, starring Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss as a married couple who find their relationship put to the test. This romantic comedy is on demand before it hits theaters.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on Cable. The Art House is now in your house.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting, streaming video units. I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I am Matt Singer, and this week on the show, we've cracked open a bottle of Chianti and cooked up a side of fava beans in preparation for talking about the early Hannibal... That's a terrible Hannibal Lecter. But we will be talking about the early Hannibal Lecter film, Manhunter.
And later in the show, we'll bring you Q-Shots, where we recommend some titles you can rent or stream at home right now, all centered on a common theme... Inspired by Manhunter, during the shooting of which Tom Noonan, who plays killer Francis Dolarhyde, stayed in character and kept away from the actors playing his victims or his pursuers, we were going to talk about other productions in which one of the stars took this kind of hardcore method approach. But then the podcast just became us speculating about what it meant that Wesley Snipes reportedly stayed in character as Blade during the shooting of Blade Trinity. Did he try to drink blood? Is it true that he only communicated to director David Goyer via post-it notes signed from Blade? When Ryan Reynolds asked him how his weekend was and he said, "Save your breath, you'll live longer," was that brilliant improvisation based on the relationship between their characters? Or was Snipes just not a fan of two guys, a girl, and a pizza place? Well, until we can get Wesley Snipes on the podcast, we will never know. So instead, we're going to talk about other adaptations of Thomas Harris's Hannibal Lecter novels. But first up is Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight a few notable films new on demand on cable. Matt, what are our picks this week?
I need to apologize for that Hannibal Lecter at the start of the show. It was really bad, even by my standards. Can only imagine the iTunes reviews we're going to get about my funny voices. I'm going to endeavor to do better. I'm going to work on it.
I would expect nothing less.
And maybe later in the show, I'll try again.
I feel like it's all in the end. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, all right. We'll talk about it later. But the Hannibal Lecter's voice is something I kind of want to talk about anyway. But we'll save that. We'll save that. Let's get to Opening Break. Some good titles to talk about on this episode. First up is the debut feature from Gia Coppola, who is Francis Ford Coppola's granddaughter. And this is her first feature. Her filmmaking style, at least so far, I would say, seems more inspired by her aunt, Sophia, than by her grandfather, Francis Ford. People call him Francis Ford? Probably just Francis. But anyway, this film is called Palo Alto. It's a vaguely Virgin Suicides-esque coming-of-age tale set in a California high school. It primarily follows the lives of three different teenagers. April, played by Emma Roberts, who has a crush on Teddy, played by Jack Kilmer, who is the son of Val Kilmer, who is also in the film in a small role.
Small, but very memorable
very,
role.
Very memorable and very amusing role. They sort of have feelings for each other. They can't quite come out and say it, though, and so they kind of wander off in different directions. April starts a relationship with her soccer coach, Mr. B, who is played by James Franco, who actually wrote the book of short stories that the film is based on, while Jack hooks up with other girls and also spends more and more time with his buddy Fred, who is played by this guy named Nat Wolff, who I guess is like a child actor.
Yeah,
I think he's either on a Nickelodeon show or a Disney show.
Yeah.
But he is great. He is sort of the class lunatic. He parties way too hard. He pranks way too hard. and he consistently puts other kids' lives in danger or in a lot of trouble without ever really considering seemingly what he's doing.
Right. Step one for doing homework is turning off your phone.
Fine.
Okay. Now, it's simple. The way to write a good history paper is to choose your event and then just explain why it happened. History is just explaining why things happen.
But what if I don't think there's a reason for something happening?
Well, then you need to think harder.
Yeah, but I do things all the time for no reason.
Mm-hmm. It's because you're young and you don't know why you do things, but there's always a reason. No?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
I mean, if you wanted to, couldn't you just say that the reason everything's happened is because of one thing that happened at the very, very, very beginning of time?
Mm-hmm. If you wanted to be a smartass.
Gia Coppola is certainly not the best filmmaker in her family yet.
It's a high bar.
It's a high bar, admittedly. And I, as I think I alluded to earlier, I'm not really sure I know or understand like her aesthetic or her style yet. This feels... The film kind of bears its influences on its sleeve, I think. But it's still a debut that I thought showed a lot of promise. It's very kind of dreamy and beautiful and sad. And it really nails that articulate inarticulateness of teenagers where, you know, they're feeling things so passionately, but they can't quite tell anyone about it. I thought that the script and perhaps even the James Franco stories, which I haven't read, I thought they captured something real about teenage life. Certainly I felt in that way at times, that feeling like, you know, you couldn't express yourself, you liked someone, you couldn't tell them, you know, like even if it seemed incredibly obvious, you couldn't actually come out and say it. That was something that I thought the movie nailed really well. And I think she's also, Gia Coppola, very good director of actors. I thought that the performances across the board in this movie were really good. I thought Emma Roberts was maybe her best performance of her career to date. Thought she was terrific. I thought Jack Kilmer, this is his first role, I thought he was really good as well. And Nat Wolff, I thought, was absolutely fantastic. I mean, he kind of reminded me when I was watching it, and I saw the movie about 2 months ago, of Hannibal Lecter. There was something about him, that vibe he gives off, and I think we'll talk about it later in the Hannibal Lecter section of the podcast. But that idea that this person is clearly insane and scary. There's something very unsettling about them. And yet, at the same time, there's something very charismatic about him. Like, you understand why people want to spend time with him, because he's charming, he's funny, he's energetic. He has some kind of, like, intrinsic aura about him that's very appealing, even though, at the same time, there's something about that aura that's kind of dangerous and unsettling as well. But you understand why people would fall under his spell, basically.
Yeah, and I thought the relationship between him and Teddy was very... very true to high school, in which that often people let themselves get steered by this like very charismatic type,
right,
despite the fact that they can be sometimes cruel to them, yes, cruel to their friends.
And Teddy is very shy and quiet, and it's just sort of like, just by the fact that Fred is so overbearing, he kind of bullies him into doing things. And yeah, so it's a good high school movie. You know, I probably not a film that's going to wind up on my end of the year list, but I think it's really worth seeing. I think it's really enjoyable, and I think you should check it out on VOD starting on August 5th. That's Palo Alto. Our next pick here is now available on VOD. It's a crime drama. I've heard a lot of good things about it. It got a very good review on the website I work for, The Dissolve. It's called Dom Hemingway. It's directed by Richard Shepard. And I guess the big appeal here, did you see this one, Allison?
I haven't yet.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either, but everyone says that Jude Law, who's the star, is really great in it. I'm reading this description from the Movies on Demand website. It says, a larger-than-life safecracker with a short fuse and a long memory sets off to collect what he's owed after 12 years in prison. And Jude Law has kind of, I think he's got kind of big, he's kind of big, he has these crazy mutton chops, he's got a very striking look. He has like the receding hairline, which is something we should credit Jude Law for, Allison. I don't know if we've ever done this on the podcast before.
He's letting that hairline recede naturally.
I find something very appealing about the fact that Jude Law is one of the few, like, 40-something actors in Hollywood who's like, I'm losing my hair, deal with it. Like, and it's not even, and he didn't do the, you know, shave my entire head thing, which is fine. I have no problem with shaving your head, though. And a lot of guys look very handsome and rugged. You know, Jason Statham has the shaved head.
Vin Diesel.
He looks great. Vin Diesel, yes. But Jude Law is like, I got a bit, you know, I got a little hair in front. And that's about it. And I don't really care. And I find that very endearing. And I think it's actually, it's brought something to some of his roles, like in Contagion, where he looked kind of, he was like the slimy reporter.
Well, he was so handsome when he, like, yes. maybe even like, not that he's not handsome still,
he's
but
still
there
handsome.
Was a period in his career.
Boyishly
where he was,
handsome.
Right. That he was so good looking yeah. that it kind of defined the types of roles he could take. And it kind of limited them in a certain way because he had to be the pretty boy,
yes.
you know? And I think that he's been taking advantage of growing into this guy who looks like a little gone to seed, or like deliberately taking these roles that are about guys who look like they've gone to
absolutely.
Seed.
Absolutely. And it adds, you're right. It adds a dimension. When you were so pretty, we bring all that baggage to it. And then now you look, he's still a handsome guy.
Absolutely.
But it's just, you know, but it's sort of like, you know, mortality, age is creeping in there. And I think that does add something really enticing to what he does. So that's Dom Hemingway, and it's available now on VOD. And finally, just very briefly, I think we both agree it's one of the best movies of the year. We reviewed it at length on Film Spotting SVU number 63, but it's Under the Skin. If you yes. want to hear our thoughts about it, you can find them, if you haven't heard it already, on Film Spotting SVU number 63. You can get that in iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com. But just wanted to make a mention for people who do watch their indie movies on demand that this movie is now available on demand. It is not to be missed. It is fantastic. Scarlett Johansson playing some kind of weird alien, cruising the streets of Scotland looking for dudes for what? I won't say. But just an incredible film, fascinating. And check out the film and then check out our discussion on Film Spotting SVU number 63.
Kids are starving in Japan, so eat it, just eat it. Don't wanna argue, I don't wanna debate. Don't wanna hear about what kind of food you hate. You won't get no dessert till you clean off your plate, so eat it. Don't you tell me you're full, just eat it. Eat it. Get yourself an egg and beat it. Have some more chicken, have some more pie.
All right. Now, I know normally we have a very, you know, we have a very standard format here. We do the opening break stuff. We talk about VOD and then we get into our picks for Q shots and then we do our review. But because we're focusing specifically on Hannibal Lecter on screen this time, and because the listener's choice review that you guys picked is Manhunter, the first film that was ever made, we thought let's mix it up. Let's do the Manhunter review first. Let's do listener's choice review first. And then we'll go, instead of just alternating picks like we normally do for cue shots, we're actually going to go just film by film in the way they, the order they were made. Although I guess we should probably do Red Dragon before we do Silence of the Lambs. I don't know. We'll have to figure this out. It's going to be interesting. We'll play it on the fly. But in any event, we're going to start with Manhunter. Then we're going to go into our picks. And we're actually going to talk about every single film in this franchise.
At different lengths.
At different lengths. But we've seen all, or in one case, one of us has seen half. I think you can
Sorry.
Guess which terrible movie in the franchise that is when we get to it. You'll see. But yeah, we were going to be able to touch on everything, including the current TV show, all the films. So this should be interesting. But let's dive in, first of all, with Michael Mann's Manhunter.
I want you to help me, Dr. Lecter. It's about Atlanta and Birmingham.
Yes?
You read about it?
In the papers. I don't tear out the articles. I wouldn't want them to think I was dwelling on anything more than that. You want to know how he's choosing them, don't you?
I thought you might have some ideas.
Why should I tell you?
You get to see the file on this case. And there's another reason.
Pray tell.
Thought you might be curious to see if you're smarter than the person I'm looking for.
Then by implication, you think you're smarter than me since you caught me.
No. I know that I'm not smarter than you.
Then how did you catch me?
You had disadvantages.
What disadvantages?
You're insane.
So in our last episode, Listener's Choice poll, we gave you three options: The Congress, The Raid 2, and Manhunter. And while it became a race between the last two options, Michael Mann's 1986 Manhunter came out on top. Since it's the first adaptation of Harris's Lecter novels, you know, that's why we're talking about it first. But it isn't the first film adaptation of his work. That would be John Frankenheimer's 1977 Black Sunday, which is a thriller about a terrorist plot starring Robert Shaw and Bruce Dern. But Manhunter, based on Harris's book Red Dragon, was the first to feature his signature character, Hannibal Lecter, who's played in the film by Brian Cox. And I think what's interesting in this first installment, which is based on the, at the time, the only book in the series that had been published, is how relatively small the part the character has is. I mean, the elements are all there. He's brilliant and dangerous. He's in captivity in this very dramatic fashion. He pokes at and taunts Will Graham, the FBI profiler who caught him, played by William Peterson of CSI. But he's not yet the larger-than-life character we get in later films. He's more a reminder of when Will got too close to the edge, when he kind of, he got hurt, basically. But the focus of the film is on Will and his hunting down of a man named Francis Dolarhyde, a serial killer played by Tom Noonan. The movie, which was Mann's third, wasn't a hit at the time, though since then, like many of Mann's films, it's become a kind of critical favorite. So Matt, my question to you is, what do you think of the character of Will, since the movie is about him and since we'll see him again in other incarnations? You know, in later movies with Clarice Starling, the relationship with Lecter is different. But with Will, and this movie particularly, sets up a sense of duality between him and, say, Lecter.
Mm. I had never seen this movie. I had seen it once before a long time ago, and I didn't really remember it very well, and it was almost like seeing it for the first time. And what I liked about it this time, and I have to say I liked it more this time, the first time I watched it, maybe because I had already seen the later Lecter movies and had them too much in my mind and was sort of expecting a movie like that, this time I didn't really care about any of that, and I was able to just enjoy it on its own terms. And there's actually more about, I'm jumping around already, but I feel like Michael Mann is a filmmaker that you kind of, like, I was never a huge Michael Mann fan in my 20s, even though everyone loves Michael Mann, right? He makes such interesting movies. Michael Mann. He makes like the...
He is the mainstream glossy filmmaker
that
who makes the
smart movies
house,
that,
right.
Right, that critics love and you're supposed to like. You know, he makes genre movies that are smart and intelligent. They're supposed to be so great. And I've always thought he was maybe a little overrated. But I recently rewatched Thief, which again I had seen when I was younger, didn't love that much, and I loved it this time. And now I watched Manhunter again, and I liked it again more than I did the first time. And I think it has something to do with the way that age and mortality and stuff like that factors into his movies. He's not making movies for a 20-something, you know? They can be enjoyed by a 20-something, one who's smarter than me, I guess, at that age. But now that I'm a little older, like, what I love about Will Graham in this movie is that he seems so kind of like chewed up and spit out by life. You know, he's wounded, he's damaged. And Peterson, and this is something I like a lot about William Peterson in this movie that I don't love as much about, say, Edward Norton in the same role in Red Dragon, is that he looks so, with respect to William Peterson, he looks horrible in this movie. He's got this hideous haircut. He hasn't shaved. You know, he has a beard, but it's more like the beard you have when you just don't shave. It's not like look at my stylish
groomed
beard.
Groomed beard, right.
Right,
yeah.
Right, exactly. He's falling up. He's fallen apart, essentially. And I think that's what I really responded to, was this idea of this guy with this incredible gift who has been destroyed by it, right? And a lot of Michael Mann's movies, now that I was thinking about this week, you know, are about middle-aged guys who are over the hill or are just the hill is just behind them, perhaps, and they have to basically acknowledge the fact that they're getting too old for this crap. That's almost like the arc for a lot of them, you know, but they can't let it go, or they're so consumed by their work, by their professionalism, by the sense that they're the best, but now they're not anymore, that it kind of destroys them. And I thought that was really fascinating about this movie, is what a good character study it is. It's a very good mystery, I think, as well. But, you know, it really puts the focus on Will Graham. It's not a Hannibal Lecter movie that's also has this other guy investigating it. It is a character study about this guy who happens to meet this psychopath named Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, and who left marks on him.
Right.
Like, and I think that is the thing you see in those relatively brief scenes in which they talk, which is that Hannibal Lecter knows that this is the guy who caught him, but also that he left some real wounds, and I do find that it's a familiar trope when it comes to movies about profilers and about people, these particular dark geniuses at catching people, you know,
right.
Which is like, maybe you've got a little darkness in you as well.
Right.
Maybe you could turn into, you've got like a taste for it, I think is like one of the things that comes up in,
yes.
in the books. And it's not, I think, always the most interesting idea. It's kind of a silly idea sometimes. But I do think that this film and later Hannibal the series actually dig into that a bit
mm-hmm.
about that worry.
Yeah.
That like putting yourself in someone else's head who's really sick, you know, like who's gone to some very disturbing places, that can somehow, that you carry that, you know, or that means that there's something problematic about you, right? That there's something wrong with you.
Mm-hmm.
And that the scenes in which Will in this movie kind of walks through the crime scenes and kind of talks his way through them, I think that like Peterson does very good work with that, in that he, you know, is basically having a conversation with someone he hasn't kind of pinned down yet with this killer, and that he makes those scenes not silly, which I think they could be, but he makes them actually kind of like makes the sense of like him working through those something believable.
And he also does this thing where he actually, and this is not easy to do, and I think without getting too ahead of ourselves again, I don't think Edward Norton does nearly as good a job of in Red Dragon, which is he actually looks like he's working these things out in his head when he's talking aloud. It doesn't seem like he's reading from a script.
Right.
He seems like he's genuinely investigating and searching. And maybe this is why this guy went on to star CSI. In CSI for
yeah.
so long, is that he brings this sense of inquisitiveness where you can see in his eyes, like he brings that like thoughtfulness and that way that he's processing things. There's a lot going on in his head, and he brings that out, which is not easy to do. Edward Norton in Red Dragon, you know, Edward Norton is a fabulous actor, but in that role, he just does seem kind of at times like he's almost sleepwalking through these rooms and just kind of reciting a script and not step by step, you know, figuring these things out, which is something that I think William Peterson does so well in this movie. Well, not at all looking like a movie star. Like, it made me go, how did this guy become a movie and TV star, because he has such an unusual, and you know,
he's kind of schlubby looking.
He's very schlubby
yeah,
looking.
Yeah, he's a little dumpy.
He's got
yeah.
I mean, when I said he has a bad haircut, I mean, that like weird fro is one of the worst haircuts.
But it's the haircut he's always had.
Right,
it's the haircut he had on television,
on
CSI, for a long time.
I know, but that's the thing is, like, I'm just impressed that he was able to overcome that haircut to become such a fine movie star and actor.
Yeah, and I think what is what this movie does well, and it's something the story, I think it's an interesting part of the story, which is that like Dennis Farina playing Jack Crawford is friends with Will, but he also knows that he's also basically manipulating him into doing something that he knows is not for his own, like not good for his friend.
Yes,
right, and that there's this whole sense that really Will should have quit. Like Will should just go home, like hang out with his family, just let it go and go behind. And yet he gets drawn back in, and it's irresistible to him in some ways to chase down these cases, right? That he's kind of a junkie about it. Like he needs to finish it and see it through,
mm-hmm.
but that it's clearly not psychologically great for him.
Yeah.
And the movie handles that fairly well as well. You know, it's always great to see Dennis Farina in a role, and he's in a relatively small one here as well. He does some nice work. So what do you think of Tom Noonan? We see him before Will ever kind of comes close to catching him. We see him kind of at work. What did you think of his Francis Dolarhyde?
You know, I wasn't wild about it. And I thought we should talk about him. And then also we have to talk briefly at least about Brian Cox as the original Hannibal Lecter. But, you know, I think he's good in the scenes with his love interest, with Joan Allen,
yeah.
a very young Joan Allen.
Yeah.
I thought those scenes, those relationship scenes, were fascinating. But I thought there was, he's deliberately, like, underplaying some of the scarier, quote-unquote, scenes, like the stuff where he kidnaps this tabloid writer who I didn't recognize, and then afterwards I was like, oh, it's Stephen Lang. It's the bad guy from Avatar.
Yeah.
Oh, totally unrecognizable, with another horrible haircut.
Horrible haircut.
And a very thick accent, like a New York accent.
He's like one of the cruelest or like most awful portrayals of a journalist.
Yeah, it's horrible.
He's like a monster.
He's absolutely horrible. But, you know, the whole thing is that he writes, he's the He's the guy that the Tooth Fairy, the Tom Noonan character, kind of follows. He reads his work, and then they deliberately plant misleading stories about him, and that offends him. And they think that that will have him, he'll try to attack Will Graham in retaliation, but instead he kidnaps
Freddie Lowndes,
the journalist, instead. And they have the scene where he kind of tortures him. And I found that scene not nearly as scary and as horrifying as it should have been. It just didn't really hit. It didn't work to me. It just didn't feel scary at all, actually. And again, well, I'll talk more about Red Dragon later, but that's one of the scenes that I think is infinitely better in Red Dragon. It's, you know, you have Ralph Fiennes and Philip Seymour Hoffman in the Dolarhyde and Lowndes roles, and that scene, the way they play it, is really intensely disturbing and very unsettling. And this version I thought was a little lukewarm. However, the scenes with Joan Allen, I thought he was really good. I mean, he plays it, he's less like a crazy serial killer and more like a messed up guy who's just, you know, he's got a little screw loose, essentially. And I think he's more convincing in those scenes than in the scenes where he goes full serial killer.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like, I mean, this movie is, it's funny that, you know, Michael Mann films always get described as like very stylish and
yes,
very sleek. And in a way that style, and I think kind of Noonan's approach as well, is not as like kind of gothic as sometimes these characters need to be, right? Like,
yeah,
it's not as garish as it needs to be.
Absolutely.
And this is a character with the Red Dragon. He's obsessed with like William Blake, and like, you know, he should be a little more over the top in some of these scenes if he's going to be
right,
that type of character.
And they even, you know, like, you never see him with the, you know, the tattoos, the famous tattoos,
right,
that the character has. And I believe that they actually shot versions of him with the tattoos. And like, if you look on Netflix or on like Letterboxd, the website, you can see the poster art that has him with the tattoos, but he doesn't have them in the movie. In the movie, he just wears like a Hawaiian shirt or something.
He just looks like a guy, like, maybe, which is the point, like,
right,
the quiet guy at your office.
Right. Well, that's something, and this is something that I think generally I like about the movie, and I think you really hit it on the head, is that these movies, especially later, the later films, become so gothic and melodramatic, and sometimes it works very well, and sometimes it veers
It's ridiculous. Yes.
It veers into camp and ridiculousness. And this film, I think one of the good things about it is it feels like it's set in our world.
Yes.
Right? That there are, like, for example, the cell that Hannibal Lecter is in, it's just a plain old ordinary jail cell, white walls with bars,
and with, I think it has like plastic.
It has,
as well, right?
You're right. It does have plastic, but
you can't, right? But it's not,
it's
like some kind of specially designed crazy movie
hell
cage.
Pit. Hell,
yeah,
pit, right? Whereas in Silence of the Lambs and in then Red Dragon, where they, you know, remade this movie, but integrated it into the world of Silence of the Lambs. So, you know, Hannibal Lecter exists in hell. Like, he literally is subterranean. There's this long process where Jodie Foster goes down, down, down all these stairs, and then into this horrible jail where it's like the walls are dripping and brick, and there's no lights.
And then he like looms out of the darkness.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
And there's no bars. There's just, it's all like plexiglass with little air holes so he can smell her. You know, it's just, and it works in Silence of the Lambs, but it's a totally different thing. Here, it's a little bit scarier because it's just a jail cell, and it feels like this is a movie that exists in the real world, and the locations are very real. Like, again, Dolarhyde, he has like a grungy apartment. That's his home base. In Red Dragon, he basically lives in the Bates Mansion, you know, like, it's totally different, and
right,
that's something I liked about this movie. But that said, I think the one downside of that approach, which is generally effective, is that you have guys like Tom Noonan kind of underplaying it, going a little small, when that role does kind of need a little bit more oomph.
Yeah, I agree. So that brings us, I think, around to talking about Hannibal Lecter.
Yes.
And I actually really like Brian Cox's take on Hannibal Lecter, which I think fits in with, as you say, like the fact that this movie seems to take place in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Brian Cox plays Hannibal Lecter as a guy. Like, he doesn't seem like a legendary monster or this kind of fantastic creation, this, you know,
right,
gourmand who's, you know, he seems like a very smart psychiatrist who also happens to be insane.
Right.
And I think that there's something about that works, especially in the context of where we'll see the character later. Mm. He's a really interesting character, and you want to know more about him.
Right, and he's in it so briefly, you could almost take him out of the movie completely. I'm sure it would easily been possible to do, actually. But he's in there, and I agree. Brian Cox is really good. It's a totally different kind of guy. And I think you nailed it again. He is kind of just, he's certainly brilliant. He's certainly devious. He's certainly evil. But he doesn't seem singularly evil. Like, Anthony Hopkins is like, his Hannibal Lecter is like a creature, you know, like a vampire or something. Yes. You know, he's like a monster.
Yes.
There's no, and also
sort of a superpower.
Yes, almost
person.
Supernatural. Yeah. Right. And Brian Cox keeps him on a, again, it seems like, he seems like somebody who could actually exist.
A psychopath.
Right.
But a very compelling psychopath.
A compelling psychopath, which again, I think does at times make the movie more, in some ways, more scary.
Yeah.
So it was your first time watching it. You enjoyed it, it sounds like.
I did. I don't think it's...
Didn't blow you away.
It didn't blow
me
away.
Not one of your favorite Michael Mann movies.
No, and I think that there are better movies that we're going to talk about. And,
yes.
And also, and TV series even. And,
oh,
yes.
Bold.
Yes.
Very
and
bold,
so,
Allison.
But I think it's a very good movie. And it
would you
is...
say it's the second best Lecter movie?
Yeah, I'll say it's the second best.
You took
best.
A long pause. All right, well, don't tell me why, because
yes.
We're going to get to talk
to
more about it. I can't wait, because to me, it's the clear number two. But I think I'm getting excited now for this discussion. All right.
All right.
Well, let's get into that. But let's wrap things up by just reminding people that this film is called Manhunter, and you can stream it right now on Netflix. Now we're going to get into the rest of the Hannibal Lecter filmography, and after a very intense off-mic debate, we almost came to blows. We're going to do this chronologically by the order in which they were made, not the storyline order. We're going to go film by film in terms of the years they were released, which means I'm going first because the first film after Manhunter was 1991's The Silence of the Lambs.
You're doing a Dr. Evil.
Yeah, what's happening?
I don't know why, like, you're.
And I just rewatched this movie last
need,
night.
Like,
it's fresh in my mind.
It's less nasal. It's more silky. It's like a Clarice.
Hello, Clarice.
I don't know. I think you've got a lot of Mike Myers in there.
Right. Okay. The Silence of the Lambs. Which made many millions of dollars at the box office. yes, 1991, The Silence of the Lambs. It's available on Netflix and, I believe, on Amazon Prime. Directed by Jonathan Demme. Screenplay by Ted Talley. And as we've already mentioned several times, this is the first Hannibal Lecter movie with Anthony Hopkins in the role. And this was, even though this is the movie we're talking about first of the Lecter series, the first one after Manhunter, this is the third film that I watched this week, right? So I rewatched Manhunter, I rewatched Red Dragon, which we'll talk about later, and last but not least, I watched Silence of the Lambs, and it really is, I think, a cut above all the other films, including
absolutely.
Manhunter, which I think is a very good film. I think Silence of the Lambs is just so far and away a better movie than
absolutely.
Any of them. And it transcends, you know, being a serial killer movie, being a franchise. It's just, I mean, it did win, what, 5 Academy Awards. It won all the major awards the year, you know, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Actor, Best Actress. And I didn't look up to see what it was up against, but I certainly think it was deserving of consideration for all of those awards. It is a brilliant film. It's a brilliant thriller, but it's also a fascinating character study. I think it's a really interesting movie about men and women. Jodie Foster, who has sort of taken over the place of the Will Graham character in the film. She's the profiler. She's the FBI character. The twist here is that instead of being the washed up, you know, aged guy who's lost his way, who's been destroyed by his career, she's young. She's a student still. She's a trainee. She hasn't even finished when the movie begins. She hasn't even finished FBI Academy. When we first meet her, she's still running courses and you know, doing training and stuff like that. So she's very young and innocent. And she's sent by Jack Crawford, who's now played by Scott Glenn, she's told she's sent to have him take a survey. They don't think he'll do it, but what the heck, we'll give it a shot. We'll send you, you're a young, beautiful woman, perhaps he'll be interested in you, and we'll use that to our advantage. But what they've what they're really doing is they're sending her in to try to get information about this serial killer named Buffalo Bill, who is kidnapping women, holding them for several days, murdering them, and taking parts of their skin as trophies. Very disturbing stuff.
Dr. Lecter, whose head is in that bottle?
Why don't you ask me about Buffalo Bill?
Do you know something about him?
I might if I saw the case file. You could get that for me.
Well, why don't we talk about Miss Moffat? You wanted me to find him.
His real name is Benjamin Raspail, a former patient of mine whose romantic attachments ran to, shall we say, the exotic. I did not kill him, I assure you, merely tucked him away very much as I found him after he'd missed three appointments.
If you didn't kill him, then who did, sir?
Who can say? Best thing for him, really. His therapy was going nowhere.
Beyond just the thriller aspects, the serial killer aspects, which are very disturbing, very effective, just the, and even beyond the characters who I think are fascinating, including Clarice and Hannibal Lecter, who have such an interesting relationship, I was really struck watching it last night, and I was even taking screen grabs and tweeting them because they were blowing my mind. Just the cinematography of this movie is just so, so good by Tak Fujimoto. Really, really incredible. And the close-ups. It has some of the closest close-ups of any movie. I mean, when you meet Lecter in that cell we were describing earlier, she comes in, and what's one of the first things he says to her? He wants to see her badge. And then what does he say? Closer, please. Closer, and she has to get closer, and then it's almost like he's talking to the camera because the camera gets closer, and then you get these close-up shots of Hopkins's face that are literally eyeballs to lips. I mean, he fills the entire frame. You can't even see his entire head. You're just seeing his face, and he's staring right into the camera, and it's like he's staring, you know, it's like the idea of like confronting evil, looking into the face of evil. This is it. This is pure evil, and we as the audience are confronting it. And they're incredible shots. And then there are other shots in the movie where I started to notice that actually a lot of the movie is from Jodie Foster's point of view, like literally point of view shots. And there's a lot of shots where it's other men like Scott Glenn, like some of the other, you know, like Dr. Chilton, the guy in the psychiatric hospital where he's kept, where Lecter is kept. They're all looking right into the camera, looking at her, but looking at us, which is fascinating. And, you know, a lot of it has to do with Jodie Foster being, you know, a smaller woman and seeing her surrounded by all these men. There's the scene where they go to the funeral home and she's the only woman in this room, and all the men, the cast guys, who are all a foot taller than Jodie Foster. So she's kind of towered over, so that idea of her being a woman in this man's world, I think, is a big part of it and is fascinating to watch as well. So when was the last time you watched Silence of the Lambs, Allison?
It's been a few years.
When
certainly.
We were picking out movies, you said you felt like you were talked out about Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, I felt a little bit. I mean, I think it's a fascinating movie for a lot of those reasons you said, but I do feel like I wanted to talk about the other movies more.
Okay.
And I think that it is, in a lot of ways, there's a clear spectrum that I think these movies go from being set in something resembling the real world to increasingly garish,
gothic, melodramatic,
nightmarish,
yes,
over the top movies. And this is like
the dividing line.
Yeah, but also obviously the sweet spot, right?
Yes.
Like, it's something that I think in some ways Manhunter is a little too procedural and a little too, despite all the stylishness,
dry.
Too dry.
Yeah.
And then once we get past this, as we'll talk, it gets into crazy territory.
Yeah.
But
it's a great point.
Yeah. You know, this is that perfect combination of the two.
Yeah.
It has
all the gothic atmosphere you want. You know,
yes.
I was talking earlier, describing that scene, that descent into hell, going to see Lecter the first time. But also, you know, Demi really focuses on details of the investigation, which is great. There's the scene in the funeral home, for example. They found a body. They're going to kind of do an autopsy. And they pause to show you, and I can't think of this happening in any other movie, and I've seen hundreds, maybe thousands of films about cops, FBI agents, investigators, autopsies. They take out this white goo
in a jar, and they smear it under their noses. I presume so they block the smell of the corpse that's been rotting in the ocean or the water. And Crawford puts it on, and one of the other guys puts it on, and they hand it to Jodie Foster, and she puts it on. And the whole scene, they have this schmutz under their noses. And I'm going, I'm sure that's a thing, but I have never seen that in any other movie like this. You know, again, focusing on the real world, not a gothic thing that's like, this is an investigation. These are detectives. They're trying to figure out a mystery. The other thing that's in the sweet spot is Hopkins, right?
Yes.
That he is, as we said, he's a monster. He's singular. He's unique. He's not like any other human being who's ever existed, but he seems real, and it's a performance too. I think one of the things that I feel about some of the later movies is that Anthony Hopkins started phoning it in a major way. Like in Red Dragon, especially in regards to the accent, which granted I've already proved I can't do. In this movie, he has this strange, unplaceable voice. You know, it's not Anthony Hopkins, it's Hannibal Lecter. And then in the later movies, he kind of just does Anthony Hopkins' voice, and he'll occasionally lapse into the Lecter-isms or the Lecter inflections. In Red Dragon, he mostly just talks like Anthony Hopkins. He has his kind of standard accent, which is really distracting and frustrating, but not here. Here he is a character. The accent is flawless. He has all these wonderful moments, and he's so charismatic, even as he's terrifying. You know, the part that I loved last night that I rewatched immediately because I had forgotten it and I loved it was, you know, in the beginning of the movie, she's trying to get him to answer this questionnaire. And finally he's won over. So she says, you know, put it in the slot, puts it in the slot, and he picks it up, and he very, very kind of grandly licks his finger and turns the page and then looks over at Jodie Foster and winks at her. And it's like, and he's leaning against the side of the jail cell, and it's so rakish and monstrous all at once. And it makes your skin crawl and it makes you laugh simultaneously. And it's just fantastic.
Yeah. And before we move on from this, Buffalo Bill is also a completely frightening serial killer.
Yes. I haven't mentioned him at all. Ted Levine, an amazing performance.
Like his voice is
weird voice.
So nightmarish.
And he has that amazing scene where he plays, again, it's another scene with point of view. He sets up a camera and plays directly into the camera.
He's dancing. Yeah.
We've already talked way too much about this movie, but another fascinating scene about looking into the camera perspective.
Oh, yeah. And it all comes around in like one of the most frightening moments towards the end involving night vision.
Yes. He's looking through night vision goggles at Jodie Foster in the dark. Again, another scene about looking. It's a pretty rich film, I think. If you've never seen Silence of the Lambs, holy God, you have to watch it because it's such a fabulous film. I've already talked like almost 10 minutes about it, which is way too long. So let's just say you should watch it on Netflix if you haven't done it. If you haven't seen it in a while, revisit it. It holds up really well. So moving on, Allison, what's our next Hannibal Lecter film?
Our next Hannibal Lecter film is Hannibal, which is currently streaming on Netflix. You know, in 1999, Thomas Harris wrote a follow-up to Silence of the Lambs called Hannibal. And despite how successful, as you've mentioned, the earlier film was, Jodie Foster, Jonathan Demme, and Ted Talley, the screenwriter, all chose to decline to participate in this new version.
Think about how much money they must have been offered to make this movie. And they still said no.
And they still said no. And I think there are some very clear reasons why they said no. And yet, I will say, the reason that I paused for a moment before saying yes.
I figured you're going to defend Hannibal here.
I think that it is such a ridiculous, crazy movie. But there's something about the way that it does not just jump the shark. It like pole vaults over the shark and then does not land. It just keeps flying off into the distance. It is like, it just throws away so much of the dynamic that I set up before in saying like, no.
I ate the shark, Clary.
Yes, exactly.
With
being
fava
like,
beans.
No, this, you know, before we used to have this crime procedural in which we had this amazing character who was a psychotic genius. Let's make what's basically a really weird romance involving him.
Right.
And also we're going to have Gary Oldman play a guy who was permanently scarred by Lecter and has been planning revenge for years by having him be eaten by feral pigs he's been raising specially in Italy.
That's just for this task.
That's just going to be, yes, just to eat this guy. That's just going to be a side storyline.
Not the main storyline.
No, side storyline. So you have Ridley Scott stepping in to direct and Julianne Moore taking over the role of Clarice Starling. And Anthony Hopkins, of course, returning in the role of Hannibal Lecter, who has been at this point on the lam, is living in Italy, where
no pun intended,
yes, where miraculously, despite like of all the many genius things he's able to do, he's able to apparently pass himself off as like a doctorate level Dante scholar in this museum, and so he's, you know, living there as a doctor when basically, like, he registers back on the radar of the FBI and of Mason Verger, who is the wealthy, deformed pedophile who donates a lot of money to the government.
Pig farmer.
Who donates a lot of money to the government. So, you know, as we've said, this series exists on a scale that kind of swings back and, or gradient that swings back and forth and, like, from classic procedural to gothic madness.
Right.
And this movie exists like well on the gothic madness side.
Yeah.
You know, but it also, I think, is such an interesting example of what happens when you fully embrace the character who was meant to be the kind of side portion of your movie. You know, the less is more character. The one who's like,
right,
you know, that we like because he makes such an impact in these small scenes.
Right, because Hannibal Lecter is always the guy in the cell, you know,
right,
that our main character goes to for advice. And yeah, he's the sizzle, not the steak. He brings, you know, the memorable moments and then he gets off the screen.
But he is the romantic hero,
right,
basically,
right,
in Hannibal.
Right.
And what's also funny is that suddenly Clarice Starling, who in the past film was this character who was kind of this woman trying to kind of make her way in this very male world and dealing with the positions he's placed in as someone who's like a newcomer and an attractive female. And then in this movie, Clarice Starling's like severely, like, has her hair always pulled back in this very severe, you know, hairstyle. And Julianne Moore wears no makeup and she's always wearing like khaki pants. And like, she's so tough and butch and like, no one really likes her because she's so severe. And like, this is what she's become and hewing out her career in a man's world.
Right.
And there's a part literally at the end of towards the end of the film in which Lecter kind of has her at his mercy, and he puts her in Gucci shoes and a black, like, you know,
he
low
glams
cut dress.
Her up.
Yes, and they go. They basically have a really disturbing date.
Right.
What's the main course? Ah, should never ask. Spoils the surprise.
Clarice, what are you doing up? You should be resting. Get back to bed.
I'm hungry.
Hello, Paul.
Paul, don't be rude. Say, hello, Agent Starling.
Hello, Agent Starling. I always wanted to watch you eat.
What have you got in your hand, Clarice? Something to bash me over the head with? Put it on the table. Let it go.
Hey, that's mine.
Now sit down. Clarice.
I love the dress. It's beautiful. What do you think, Paul?
Nice.
Nice. Yeah.
I love and hate this take on their very complicated relationship in Silence of the Lambs to have it be this basically strange courting,
right,
ritual. Worse, I think, this is not how the movie ends, but the book ends with them running off and becoming lovers.
Right.
And this is not even in defense of the movie, just an observation. I barely recognize Hannibal Lecter as Hannibal Lecter.
That's a fair point, too.
He is like, you know, in the first movie, he has these kind of aristocratic sensibilities as much as you can tell from them coming through. He's in jail.
Right.
He's in cell. In this, he like literally is this aesthete who, you know, only eats the finest gourmet food, can translate Dante on the fly.
He's almost like a snob avenger. It's,
yes,
like when things offend his sensibilities, you know, it's like they throw up the Hannibal signal and he goes off to avenge these wrongs, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. But that said, this also is the movie even more than, certainly more than Silence of the Lambs or the other ones, that has the kind of like, the kind of shocking violence that I think comes out later in the TV series,
mm-hmm,
which is like not just excessive violence necessarily, but scenes of violence that are kind of imaginatively horrific.
Yeah.
Including towards the end on the dinner date, which I won't describe what happens because if you haven't seen the movie yet, it's better to leave it as a horrible, horrible surprise. But it's a very memorable image that you will never scrape out of your brain.
So, I mean, so this was the one you were debating about. I mean, we've almost
because
talked another 10 minutes.
It.
You kind of love it.
Yes.
And you would recommend it.
Yes, absolutely. But only you have to see you have to see A Silence of the Lambs first. I feel like part of what is so great about it is just how different it is, like the kind of the wild turn it takes.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And if you're done, I think that's a great segue to the next movie, which is Red Dragon, because I would almost say the exact same thing about Red Dragon. You know, that it's a movie that you kind of have to see as an experiment or in juxtaposition with another movie, which is Manhunter. You know, like, and to me, there's no question Manhunter is the better movie overall. And if you were only going to see one version of that story, you should see Manhunter. But it's like, once you see Manhunter, you should go watch Red Dragon, because it's a fascinating experiment in, here's two filmmakers with the same material making almost an identical movie and also a vastly different movie. You know, it's the same exact story pretty much, but with such different treatment in the ways we were talking about earlier, with Michael Mann taking a fairly grounded approach and filming in seemingly real locations and giving it kind of this gritty feel, and Red Dragon, directed by Brett Ratner, you know, almost taking it into a totally different direction and trying to, again, fit it into the Hopkins-verse of Hannibal Lecter and inserting a much older Anthony Hopkins into this prequel film. I mean, such a prequel to the point where, like, the last scene of the movie is Hannibal Lecter in his cell and Dr. Chilton, the same actor, they brought back the same guy to play Dr. Chilton, coming and saying, Hannibal, there's a woman here to see you. I don't think you'd want to see her, but I'm just going to tell you you're going to go. And he's like, that's good. Wait a second. What's her name? And, like, that's, like, the last shot of the movie, and that is kind of horrible. And the other big difference, I guess, is the sort of finale of the mystery plot is a little different. I won't spoil that. The other big difference is the first couple of scenes of the movie are additions, new scenes, sort of what you were talking about with, you know, Hannibal as this, you know, aesthete, you know, snob, you know, righteous avengers. You know, it opens with him in a symphony, and there's one guy in the symphony who's playing bum notes and making Hannibal wince. And so the next scene, we hear that guy is missing, basically. He is eliminated. He's ruining the symphony. He's ruining music. Hannibal must right the wrong. So that guy's eliminated off screen. And then the Will Graham character, who is played now by Edward Norton, comes to see him about a case and realizes that Hannibal Lecter is the guy who's, you know, the killer. And so we see him essentially catch Hannibal Lecter. We find the origin of that relationship, I guess. But I was describing this last night on Letterboxd as Brett Ratner's Gus Van Sant's Psycho, right? It's almost scene for scene. It's not shot for shot, but it's almost scene for scene. Some of the dialogue is identical. Some of the shots are identical. One of the odd things is, even though the movies do look very different, you know, they're shot by the same person, shot by the same cinematographer, which is, you would not expect looking at them at all, but they were shot by the same guy. Dante Spinotti actually shot both Manhunter and Red Dragon, which is kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
But I watched them back to back, Manhunter and Red Dragon, you know, 2 days. One day I watched Manhunter, the next day I watched Red Dragon. And I really feel like that is an interesting double feature, even though I don't think Red Dragon is a great movie, but just to see them side by side, because you really don't get to do that very often. I definitely prefer Manhunter. Even, you know, I would say, to Red Dragon's credit, you know, the cast is A-list all the way. Edward Norton, who I already said not as good as William Peterson, and Harvey Keitel plays Jack Crawford. I don't think he's as good as Dennis Farina. But you have Ralph Fiennes as the Tooth Fairy, and I think he gives a really good performance. As I said earlier, I think his scenes really kind of elevate that character to that level of crazy gothicness that you want, and he kind of gets a little bit of a a Norman Bates backstory. We find out through kind of audio flashbacks, a couple of scenes, that he was abused by his grandmother. He lives in this crazy big house. It is a little psycho-ish, but it works. I think it works. He has the crazy tattoo on his back, and it does have that gothic aspect. It's more over the top. It's the sort of movie that you want to hate because it's completely superfluous, right? Because why do we have Manhunter? It's a good movie. We don't need just to see Anthony Hopkins in the movie, just to see them add more scenes with Anthony Hopkins to try to kind of force him into a more central role. But it kind of still works. And it's interesting to compare. So I would say that. So it's Red Dragon. You can rent it on all the usual suspects, iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, all the normal places. And I would say, if you're going to watch one, watch Manhunter. But if you watch Manhunter and you like it, you might want to check out Red Dragon.
So Red Dragon is one that I haven't seen, and you've kind of sold me on it. It's after
it's
after
sort
watching...
of fascinating.
Yeah. Well, before we move on to Hannibal the TV series, which is my other pick, we'll briefly mention that there is, of course, the 2007 Hannibal Rising, the prequel The World Demanded. This is the movie I watched half of.
I've never seen it.
Yeah.
It's supposedly terrible.
It is terrible. The half I watched was horrible, at least. But it is available for rent. And if you were a Hannibal Lecter completist, it is out there. It is about the formative years of Hannibal Lecter, which is really, I think, the worst thing you can possibly do to a character like this, who is all about
Hannibal colon origins.
Right? Like, this character was all about kind of mystery and, you know, as you said, these kind of undefinable accents.
He seems larger than life. The worst thing you can do is give him a backstory.
Right. And be like, here's how he became Hannibal the serial killer.
Right.
And it's just, yeah. But so it stars Gaspar Ulliel, French actor, as Hannibal Lecter, and Gong Li, the great Chinese actress, as Lady Murasaki.
Does it explain how Hannibal Lecter went from being French to not being French?
He's Lithuanian, which is, he grew up in Lecter Castle in Lithuania. I think, like, beyond the fact that you have, like, these two leads who are great actors, who neither of which seems terribly comfortable speaking English at all, you have this just ridiculous story about World War II and about, like, Hannibal's little sister and this terrible thing that happened during the war, and then how he wants to have his revenge, and then has this random Japanese aunt with whom he has sexual tension, and it's insanely ridiculous and not in a good way. So I don't recommend it. It's not a good thing to do to the character nor to these poor actors, but it existed. And it is out there if you want to rent it. All right. Well, that brings us to Hannibal, the TV series, which you can just wrapped up its second season on NBC. The first season is available for streaming on Amazon Prime Instant Video. The second season, I think you can watch the last three episodes at the moment on Hulu, but the rest of it you'll have to rent on iTunes.
Or on Amazon,
or the other places, but you have to pay for.
Yes.
And then the third season, I think, is set for probably, it's usually a mid-season show, so probably January, but I don't think they've announced it yet. But I would say this is, if I were to rank adaptations of Lecter novels, I would go with Silence of the Lambs, Hannibal the TV series, Manhunter, Hannibal the movie, haven't seen Red Dragon, Hannibal Rising.
But it couldn't be worse.
I could not
than Hannibal
be,
Rising.
Yeah. And, but that way, way down at the bottom, Hannibal Rising.
Yeah.
I think that Hannibal the TV series does something really interesting in a way by going to the far edges of that kind of gothic weirdness.
Yeah.
And embracing it and having this real, like, it's set in this world that's kind of beautiful. It's this beautiful nightmare of a world in which, like, just things are just off. They're so, but it's a creation of Brian Fuller, who has done a lot of other more whimsical TV series like Wonder Falls and Pushing Daisies. And this is much, much darker than anything he's done before. And also, frankly, than almost anything I think I've ever seen, maybe ever on network television.
It's gruesome.
It's gruesome. And its gruesomeness is not like due to high body count necessarily. Like, there are certainly other shows, serial killer shows,
sure,
on TV that have more people dying.
It's not the quantity, it's the quality.
It just
here.
Yeah. I mean, the one that always stands out to me because it happens early on in the show is that there's a one where they start to investigate a guy who has left people comatose, who are comatose. He has buried them shallowly with air things and bags.
Horrible.
Yeah, bags, drip bags to keep them alive.
Bury them
longer.
Alive.
So like their arms, like coming out of the ground.
Doesn't he turn them into?
But
like,
he's been using them as like fertilizer, living fertilizer for mushroom
beds.
It's
horrible.
Basically,
it's so
just
horrible.
Like, and those are the kind of ideas that they have happen. I will not go into this because I know you haven't seen it yet. But there's something that happens to a character in season two that is so. I was watching it recently and I still like I'm having trouble kind of getting over it because it's such a like distinctively horrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the show does have some of the most imaginatively awful violence I've seen in movies or television.
Good morning, Will. May I come in?
Where's Crawford?
Deposed in court. The adventure will be yours and mine today. May I come in? I'm very careful about what I put into my body, which means I end up preparing most meals myself. A little protein scramble to start the day. Some eggs, some sausage.
But I will say that I think it uses it to uses it well. It's not gratuitous, not just because of the nightmarishness of like this is a prequel that is set in that moment that you would have mentioned in Red Dragon.
Right. It basically expands that introduction
backstory.
Of Red Dragon.
Yeah.
Where Will and Hannibal are essentially
working
partners.
Together.
Yes.
Yes. And no one knows that Hannibal Lecter is a serial killer yet.
Right.
They just think he's his genius. Psychiatrist. He's played by Mads Mikkelsen. And I think dealing with a character who is so carries so much baggage at this point manages to bring something new to it by having him be this super, super gourmand, super, you know, like super civilized, but also so dead behind the eyes. Like there's something just so like it's like he's wearing a human skin, but he's just not a person. He's something alien.
Right.
And he likes Will, who is played by Hugh Dancy, because he finds him interesting, as much as like he can have affection for a human being, but also kind of like over the course of things does like horrible things to him or treats him very badly without Will knowing. And their dynamic is the central one in the series and goes to some very interesting places in season two, which I won't go into, but I think those two actors play off so well together. I mean, the show runs with the idea that is brought up in Manhunter of being able to get into someone's head,
right.
Being this kind of terrible gift, right? That exacts a toll.
And it visualizes it in a really interesting way.
Right. There's almost this metronome, like a kind of metronome of light that goes across the screen and Will can reverse into this scene and often puts himself in the place.
He puts himself in the
of
room.
Of the killer.
He becomes the killer.
Right.
It's not just that he can like think about it. It's like he reenacts them with him as the killer. And I think that adds a really interesting, disturbing dimension to it.
Right.
And the other thing is like when those flashbacks are much more beautiful and warm.
Yes.
Like reality is cold in Hannibal. But those like flashbacks are so invitingly warm. It's like beckoning him to become a psychopath, you know, which is really interesting.
And the image, like he, unlike other shows, and this starts off more procedural than it ends up by even the end of season one.
Mm-hmm.
But that like he's not able to shrug off these things, nor are we, because they're really horrible. But he's not able to shrug them off easily. And there's a real, the TV series deals with very like intently the idea of being maybe more porous to violence than other people. You know, that part of this is about, as much as we always say, like, there's violence on television, you know, like, what does it actually have any effect on people? For Will, it does, in a way. You know, like, that he is so more vulnerable to it and can absorb it, and that's part of the reason he's able to get inside it so easily. Mm-hmm. But it also, like, infects him in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Hugh Dancy does a very good job of looking like he's going to have, like he just looks horrible as well.
He actually does kind of look like William Peterson.
Yeah,
in
like
Hannibal.
He looks like he's
in Manhunter.
I mean, Hugh Dancy is a more traditionally handsome guy.
Yes, but he has the beard, the
he looks
the
like a mess.
Hair.
Like you see his home life and it's a disaster.
Yeah.
Like he's got all of these adopted dogs and that's it. And And, you know, this is a beautiful show for one that is so horrific. And Brian Fuller does some, he has this reoccurring image of a, like this all black stag that Will keeps seeing that becomes, it kind of becomes a through line into season two as well. And it's very, it's pretty haunting. I think that the show does some great work with its visuals and with creating this coherent sense of a world gone wrong, a world in which these terrible things keep presenting themselves to you and that there's no maybe getting away from them. So I would highly, highly recommend this show. I think it feels like almost a happy accident that it ended up on air and that it's kept going. And I think if you have any interest in this franchise, as obviously both of us do, that it presents this really nice bookend to it in kind of taking the character and all of these things that have kind of been done to the character and like running with them and managing to fold them up into this kind of neat new story. So that is Hannibal. The first season is available to stream on Amazon Prime Video, and the second season is available for rent.
We'll get to our Behind the Eight Ball segment in just a moment, but I was thinking, because Allison here is the film critic for BuzzFeed. This is untapped resource that we're not exploiting enough. You don't do enough work on this podcast, Allison.
I don't.
You need to work harder. So I'm thinking, maybe right around this time of the show, we should have you tell us about the new movies that are coming out in theaters. I know we're a streaming podcast. We're about movies at home. But I know we've got a lot of film fans that want to know about the new movies as well. And I think people would enjoy hearing just very briefly. And I can weigh into when I've seen something. But you're you know, as the critic for BuzzFeed, you're seeing all the big movies every week.
Yes.
I'm seeing probably half. So, like, this week, for example, I've seen one of them, I can weigh in, but you've seen both. So, I just wanted your quick thoughts. We'll have to come up with a name for this segment.
Okay.
That'll come. But I just want what your thoughts of the big movies. First of all, about the big Marvel movie that's apparently better than life itself, according to my Twitter feed, Guardians of the Galaxy. Did you enjoy it?
I did. I liked it a lot.
Is it better than life itself? Not the movie,
not the
by
movie,
Roger Ebert.
Life
no, the actual concept of life.
No, I'd say probably life still holds supreme over a Marvel movie. But I thought this was such a great time and also so refreshingly weird compared to what's become this kind of Marvel look and feel, mm-hmm. right? Like, as much as all of the different Marvel movies have their own, Thor is like kind of more fantasy. Captain America is, I mean, this last one has become almost like a
spy
conspiracy
movie, conspiracy
thriller.
Movie.
Yes, but that, I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy looks like a throwback to like an 80s space opera.
Yeah,
right?
A colleague of ours, I think John Golson, who writes for movies.com, I think said it's like a Star Wars knockoff from like the late 70s and early 80s. And that's really what it feels like, you know, Ice Pirates or
yes,
one of those
exactly.
movies.
Yeah. And then there's something very joyful about that mm-hmm. in the way
it's fun.
Just,
I this one I have seen. It's fun. I think
I'm more enthusiastic about it. Than
you might be. I think there's some, I thought it was an action movie. It was unsuccessful. You know, I didn't really enjoy any of the action scenes. I just really enjoyed the characters and the camaraderie and the connections between them.
Oh yeah. And it has a fantastic cheesy soundtrack of 60s and 70s pop standards, basically.
Really great. That I already made a Spotify playlist of the entire soundtrack.
That it uses, yeah, it's so good.
Very good.
I love it. So I don't know. I was a big fan. You were a fan as well.
Yes.
I think certainly you've heard.
Worth
sure.
a trip.
If you've been on the internet at all, you've heard plenty about this movie already. But I would say James Gunn, you know, who's someone we like a lot. We're both a big fan of Slither. He's got a certain sensibility that he does manage to bring to this, even in the midst of like what is a giant corporate enterprise at this point.
All right. So you would recommend that one. Now, the other big movie of the week is Get On Up,
yes.
which is the James Brown biopic. This one I haven't seen. Should I go out and see it?
I think so. This was actually a huge surprise for me.
Oh.
I was filled with dread going into this because, you know, the musical, we've talked about musical biopics. We've talked about how much we enjoyed the film making fun of musical biopics.
Walk Hard.
And this movie starts off with James Brown backstage at an arena where people are chanting his name and he's like walking out through the crowd in the dark into
James
the shadow.
Brown must remember his entire life
and
before
he actually
goes
says
on stage.
There's one part like they're kind of flashing snippets of audio and one of them is like, James Brown don't need nobody. And I was like, oh no. And then it flashes to 1988 And it has this whole deadpan, very funny sequence in which a drug-addled James Brown figures out that someone at like the neighboring business in his strip mall has been using his bathroom and charges into what looks like a kind of business conference with a shotgun and goes onto this long ramble to these terrified people about when you choose to do a number two and where. And it's hilarious and it's completely weird. And you realize that this movie is not going to just trudge through his life and hit all the big moments.
So it's not a walk hard, like,
not
biopic.
At all.
It's weird.
It's very impressionistic. It skips like from place to place. There's something like very powerful about it. And also Chadwick Boseman, who's the lead, who is in 42 and has been kind of,
he was
like,
really good in that.
Yeah.
Too.
And he, you know, is like someone who doesn't, he's a relatively newcomer. Mm. He manages to, I mean, this is a character who's known for being like one of the most energetic performers, right?
Sure.
And it's a tough thing to bring to like the camera, but I think that he actually manages to do that. He's very, like, he's incandescent in this role.
Wow.
You know, and this is from the director of The Help. There was no reason to think that this movie would be as kind of unconventional
right.
as it is.
I'm pleasantly surprised. So, yes. So you like that one quite a bit.
I
do
did.
You like that more than Guardians of the Galaxy?
No, I like Guardians of the Galaxy the best, but.
But you like.
But I did.
Too.
I like this a lot. I would pretty happily sit through both again right now.
Wow.
So.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Great. Well, thank you for that. Well, next in 2 weeks, we will come back. At the end of August, I'm sure there'll be some great movies
some
we
great
want to hear
ones.
About. But when we get towards the end of the year, I'm sure there'll be a lot of really interesting movies we're going to want your reports on. So thank you. And for people who, we need suggestions for what to call that. That's that miniature segment. So perhaps people can send in some suggestions to SVU at FilmSpottingSVU. All right, let's move on to Behind the Eight Ball. This is the part of the show where we wrap things up with three new releases, two listener recommendations, and one film chosen blindly by number from our My Lists. Lots of recommendations, lots of stuff for you guys to watch at home on Netflix and other services. Do you want me to go first since you just did all
that?
Yeah,
and I want to say we got a great response in terms of people sending in recommendations this time. We weren't able to fit in all of them, but if
we're going
to
save them
for our next show. So yes. If you don't hear your recommendation this time, we have not thrown it away callously.
No.
We're very happy to have them.
Yes.
All right, Matt, so if you're going first, are you ready?
I am ready.
All right, three new releases.
All right, this is one you tweeted about and mentioned me as if it would be something I'd be interested in.
I suspected it would be.
You were right. I was interested. It's Pumping Iron from 1977. It's streaming now on Netflix. Certainly, I've seen it a few times. Certainly, I own it on DVD. But for people who haven't seen it, it's a really great film. This was wasn't Arnold Schwarzenegger's first movie. He'd actually made several forays into the world of movies by this point. But this is really his first breakthrough. Documentary about the world of bodybuilding. It follows him as he prepares for his final Mr. Olympia competition. He's supposedly going to retire after it. And it's contrasting him and his kind of hippie-ish, easygoing California lifestyle with his big opponent in the film, which is, and in Mr. Olympia competition, is this shy, deaf, but, you know, hulking, no pun intended, kid named Lou Ferrigno, who lives in Brooklyn. And it's a fun film. It's not really it's a documentary, but they've admitted in recent years that it was largely staged. Obviously, the competition is real, but it's almost like this is interesting. I'm doing this right off the top of my head, but this is kind of almost a prototype for reality television, where it's real people playing themselves. The competition is real, but the storylines are basically kind of fudged, written, invented for the sake of drama, to hype up the drama. I think Arnold Schwarzenegger has called it a docudrama. Bodybuilding propaganda might also work, because it was really designed to kind of encourage people to check out the sport of bodybuilding, to kind of bring it into the mainstream. So certainly not the most objective film, but a very satisfying documentary. Pumping Iron, now streaming on Netflix. Streaming now on Crackle is a fabulous bad movie. I Know Who Killed Me is the title of it. Have you ever seen it, Allison?
I have.
And?
It's magnificent.
It's transcendent. Lindsay Lohan stars as a young woman named Aubrey who vanishes on her way home from she's out partying with her friends. She's found days later. She's lost a hand. She's lost a leg. But don't worry, she gets robotic replacements very quickly, because that's what happens in the real world when you unfortunately have your leg and hand amputated. When she's found, though, without these appendages, she's insistent that she is not Aubrey. She is a stripper named Dakota. And what follows is a trashy mystery, a bizarre sex comedy,
and an endless parade of crazy over-the-top stylistic flourishes, most involving the color blue, because the killer is obsessed with the color blue, or the killer or the kidnapper, whatever he is. It is a terrible, terrible film, but just fascinatingly, fascinatingly bad and strange and weird and very much funny and worth watching. That's I Know Who Killed Me, streaming on Crackle. And finally, a film we actually have recommended previously on the show in this very segment, back when we used to do expiring picks, when it was easy to find out when things were expiring.
Right. Now Netflix is going to make it even difficult to find what's new.
Yeah, that's not going to be fun. Yeah. But anyway, so it expired back in the day, but it's now back on Amazon Prime. It's Layer Cake, a crime film from Matthew Vaughn that really launched Daniel Craig's movie stardom and kind of was his feature-length audition tape for the role of James Bond. He plays this unnamed but very suave and debonair crime lord who considers himself a businessman, not a gangster, but he's kind of, you know, it's the classic thing. He's trying to get out of the business. He doesn't want to be a criminal anymore. He wants to be a legitimate businessman, but of course there are complications. It's a very stylish and funny film. It's suspenseful, and Daniel Craig really gives a great performance that definitely launched him to the James Bond role. It's got a great ending, too, which I would never spoil, of course, but I love the ending of Layer Cake. It's one of the first things that comes to mind when I think about that film. So that's Layer Cake, and that is streaming now on Amazon Prime.
All right, two listener recommendations.
All right, our first recommendation comes from Jason in O'Fallon, Missouri, who's actually got a kind of like a piggyback recommendation off of my recommendation from our last episode when I recommended this excellent found footage movie called The Conspiracy. And Jason writes, "Fans of The Conspiracy will enjoy Banshee Chapter. While it's not a found footage film, it is an effective, low-budget horror conspiracy tale. The film combines the real-life Project MK-Ultra mind control experiments the CIA conducted during the Cold War with H.P. Lovecraft's From Beyond. The film also contains a great performance from Ted Levine, who we were mentioning from Silence of the Lambs. He portrays a writer who is a dead ringer for Hunter S. Thompson. Banshee Chapter is currently streaming on Netflix and well worth the time for people who enjoy discovering unknown low-budget gems." And that sounds great. I just added it to my list. That was Banshee Chapter from Jason in Missouri. Our second recommendation here comes from Paul in Baltimore, Maryland. Paul writes, "I tweeted this at you guys, but then remembered you prefer things in email." And we do. Tweets are great. We love getting tweets. But for this segment, we love the emails even more. Email us, svu@filmspottingsvu.com. So Paul writes, "I'm a rather new listener, so I don't know if you've recommended this before or not, but I'd like to recommend an indie horror thriller called Resolution, directed by Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead. Without delving too deeply into the plot, it involves a man attempting to rid his best friend of a methamphetamine addiction by holding him hostage in a half-completed and abandoned cabin in the woods and forcing him to experience withdrawal. From here, things take a turn for the unexpected, but at the risk of over-explaining and ruining where the story goes, I won't get into it. Comparisons to intrigue you: Cabin in the Woods, Scream, and Cabin Fever. Once again, if you guys have talked about this before, you can just ignore me, but I love the show." That's Paul from Baltimore, Maryland. And I was asking, I can't remember if we have talked about that movie before.
I don't think so.
But I have seen it. We did a feature on The Dissolve last year for Halloween of underrated horror movies, where each day of the week of Halloween, someone from the site recommended an underrated or underseen horror movie. And Tasha Robinson's pick was this film, Resolution. So to talk about it with her on the site, I watched it. And it's a really interesting movie. Super strange and smart and scary. And, you know, just what you want out of a low-budget movie, which is it doesn't have a ton of production value, but they make the most of it. And it's really full of cool ideas. So I'm going to definitely second Paul's recommendation, Resolution. That's streaming on Netflix. Definitely worth checking out.
All right. And one from your Netflix My List.
You gave me number 88, which is Kagemusha, which is the Akira Kurosawa film, one of his very last films. Here's the Netflix description. Three clans battle for control of medieval Japan. When the leader of one clan is wounded, the clan searches for an exact double to take his place. And this is just, it's a Kurosawa film I've never seen. I've seen probably between 5 and 10 of his movies, probably closer to 10, maybe even 10 or maybe even more than that, now that I'm counting them up in my head, but I've never seen this one. So it's on the list. I think it got added fairly recently. and I, or maybe I just noticed it on there recently, and I threw it on there. So it's sort of towards the bottom of my list at the moment. Hopefully I get a chance to check it out sooner rather than later. Allison, it's your turn. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Let's start with three new releases.
Okay. First up is new to Netflix, Southcliffe, which is a British miniseries that aired on Channel 4 last year and then also played at Toronto, which is a kind of rare move for the Toronto Film Festival to show a TV show. But in this case, it is director Sean Durkin's follow-up to his kind of big like hit with critics, Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. It was the thing he made after that. It is written by Tony Grissoni, who co-wrote Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and Tideland with Terry Gilliam. And it is basically about a mass shooting in this small fictional small town of the title. And it circles around to different people in the town and kind of how where they were that day and how they were affected, like, in, you know, including the shooter. So it is, you know, incredibly uplifting, as you can imagine with that description. It is, I think, a neat example of, as much as we think of TV as a writer's medium, and it's often described that way, Southcliffe, along with The Nick, which is coming up on Cinemax from Steven Soderbergh, or directed by Steven Soderbergh, and True Detective, I would argue, are all shows that have seemed to me more about how they're directed. Or the direction has been more distinctive to
director
me.
Director first.
Yes, than the writing. And I think that's kind of maybe proof of how TV is opening up and becoming more cinematic. But that is Southcliffe. It is available on Netflix. Available on Fandor right now, unless you are in New York, is The Strange Little Cat, which is I haven't seen this yet. I'm really looking forward to seeing it. It's a surreal German family drama from filmmaker Ramon Zurcher. It opened in theaters in New York, which is why you can't stream it here yet. But it's gotten a lot of critical love. Our friend Ben Kenningsberg reviewed it for the New York Times and wrote, "Mr. Zurcher has concocted something intimate yet otherworldly with his highly original debut." So if you're not in New York right now, you can watch it on Fandor, which is kind of a neat thing they've been doing with a few recent releases. And finally, new to Amazon Prime Instant Video is Enemy, one of two recent movies about someone meeting their doppelganger. This is the one directed by Denis Villeneuve, who is the director of Incendie. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal as two characters, one a kind of bookish professor and the other a hot-tempered actor. And they turn out to look exactly identical, and they meet and strange things happen.
That's a really good movie, actually. I liked it, and people should check that one out. Yeah, it's cool that one's streaming. All right, how about two listener recommendations?
All right, first one is from Evan from Montana, who writes in to say, "I suggest that folks give a Mission Impossible entry a revisit. The Brian De Palma film was always appreciated for its style, while Mission Impossible 3 is getting love as J.J. Abrams' star continues to rise. Mission Impossible 4 got favorable reviews when it came out last year, and critics lauded the jump Brad Bird made from animation to live action. Left out of this discussion and generally discarded is the John Woo film Mission Impossible 2. I have been watching a lot of Asian cinema recently, which includes many John Woo films, but anybody who has become acclimated to CGI can appreciate the ludicrous practical effects employed by MI2. The filmmaking is top-notch, with surprisingly languorous scenes allowing time for sexy chemistry to build between the leads. Digital effects are used sparingly and to great effect, discounting the absurd masks. In summary, MI2 has aged in unexpected ways, but seeing it today invokes pleasant nostalgia for slower camera moves, real pyrotechnics, and excessive slow-mo." And that is available on Netflix. And Chris from North Carolina writes in with two quick recommendations. First off, he says, "Based on Captain Kempinar from the Mothership's recommendation, I rented Mistaken for Strangers from iTunes. Not being all that familiar with the band The National, I was surprised by how much I enjoyed the film." And secondly, Gideon's Army is a 2013 documentary about dedicated public defenders who work long hours for low pay but are committed to their cause. I caught it on Netflix, where I think it just recently surfaced after being screened on HBO, but I believe it is also available for rent on iTunes and Amazon. So thank you, Chris. Two doc recommendations, and we don't always get a lot of doc recommendations.
Yeah, that's good stuff. All right, and how about one random film from your my list?
You gave me number 100, which is Flame and Citron. This is a period drama based on a true story about two Danish resistance fighters who assassinated collaborators and Nazis in during World War II. It's one that I remember coming out, heard fairly good things about. Happens to star Mads Mikkelsen as one of them, not Flame. Flame has red hair. He's Citron, I guess. I don't know why he's a lemon. But never got around to watching it. And maybe someday I will.
Okay, well, let's get to our listener's choice options for our next episode. Oh, man, we've got some interesting ones this time. I'm very curious what's going to win. Let's start with this one from Netflix. It is Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow, directed by Kerry Conran from 2004. Famously, this unique-looking film, this almost experimental film, which has now become kind of almost a sub-strain of movies, which is something shot basically entirely on a green screen or a blue screen. Kerry Conran was this guy. I think he spent years working on the demo for this thing all by himself. You know, animating it, shooting it. He made a demo in his house with his PC, basically, and then took that around and got a financing deal. And then he was able to make a fairly large version of this story with big actors, Jude Law, Angelina Jolie, Gwyneth Paltrow, all on green screens and blue screens. It's sort of this pastiche of pulp and science fiction about this heroic pilot and a plucky reporter, and they're battling the forces of evil and they're investigating a mystery. And I haven't seen this movie since it came out. You know, it was got a lot of attention when it came out for being such an unusual and unique looking movie. And I remember liking it, and I'm very curious to see how it aged and to kind of take stock of, you know, that this thing, this, you know, green screen shooting, which is kind of become a huge part of movie making.
Inescapable at this point.
You know, 10 years later, this would be not a big deal in the slightest. 10 years ago, this was a huge deal, this movie. It got a ton of press. Didn't make a lot of money, but it was certainly one of the more talked about films of that year. So I think it would be very interesting to go back, look at it. Maybe we could do green screen films as like the Q shots.
And I'd certainly be interested to just talk about that in general, to be like, now it's pretty taken for granted that we can basically do anything.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like, how does that change the way we look at movies?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow. Option one, streaming on Netflix.
All right. Option two is a movie that I already talked about, or not a movie, a TV series. It's Southcliffe, Sean Durkin's British TV series. And I think, you know, maybe there's something we can talk about filmmakers working in television, which is happening more and more.
Right.
Or about cinematic television, or about, I don't know, things about mass shootings. That sounds like an incredible downer.
Yeah,
but it's a really well made.
You've seen the whole thing?
I have seen the whole thing.
I've seen none of it.
Yes.
But I was a big fan of his
Martha
film,
Martha Marcy May Marlene.
So yeah, the fact that it's his follow up definitely intrigues me.
Yeah, and I think he's a very talented filmmaker, and he brings some kind of unusual techniques to the screen in this one.
Okay,
so that is Southcliffe, and it is available on Netflix.
Okay, and our last option is available for rental on iTunes. And it's called The Lunchbox, directed by Ritesh Batra, starring Irfan Khan and Nimrod Kaur. And this is one of the biggest art house indie movies of the year. It's made over $4 million in U.S. theaters, which is fantastic, especially for a small foreign film without big movie stars, this little Indian film. And it got great reviews. It supposedly is really a wonderful film. Neither of us have seen it yet,
right.
So we're just hoping to catch up with it. The story supposedly is about these two strangers who connect because of a mix-up with a lunchbox. This unhappy wife tries to cook her husband like a fabulous meal for lunch to get him to pay more attention to her. The lunch is waylaid somehow, and it winds up in the hands of Irfan Khan's character, who is this kind of lonely older man. And then the two characters start a correspondence through the lunchbox, passing back and forth these letters, and follows their lives from there and how their connection kind of changes their lives. So supposedly is like a heartwarming, crowd-pleasing film, has done really well, and it's one that I want to catch up with before the end of the year, and so I think this would be a good chance for us to do that.
All right. It's quite a range.
It's an eclectic
of
range,
picks
yes.
This time. Quite an eclectic, interesting mix of choices this time around.
Very interesting batch, yes.
Yeah, so which one should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? You can send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com, or even easier, enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com, and your vote must be received by Monday, August 11th at noon. And after that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, which is at FilmSplottingSVU. And you'll have all that week to watch the film or TV series. And then join us for our conversation on next week's episode, which will be on Tuesday, August 19th.
FilmSplottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discuss on the show. And the FilmSplotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal, and you can listen to more of Vince's work at VinceVandal.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the movie or TV miniseries review you pick. But in the meantime, you can always follow us on Twitter, at Allison Wilmore, at Matt Singer, and you can also follow the show at FilmSplottingSVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice and where we share more streaming suggestions from you guys, the SVU listeners, and for you guys, the SVU listeners. And remember, keep sending your streaming suggestions to us via email as well, svu@filmspottingsvu.com. And for FilmSpotting SVU, I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.
Hello, Clarice.
I still don't have it.
Dr. Evil.
I can't do it.